miracle that my would-be boss appeared to get it. If he had any reservations, listening to me explain how flex time was a necessity while I bounced Sasha on my lap, hoping all the while that her diaper wouldn't leak, he didn't express them. I walked out of the interview feeling pleased and fairly certain I'd be offered the job. But no matter how it panned out, I knew I'd at least done something good for myself in speaking up about my needs. There was power, I felt, in just saying it out loud. With a clear mind and a baby who was starting to fuss, I rushed us both back home. This was the new math in our family. We had 2 kids, 3 jobs, 2 cars, 1 condo, and what felt like no free time. I accepted the new position at the hospital. Barack continued teaching and legislating. We both served on the boards of several nonprofits, and as much as he'd been stung by his defeat in the congressional primary, Barack still had ideas about trying for higher office. George W. Bush was now president. As a country, we'd endured the shock and tragedy of the terror attacks of 9/11. There was a war going on in Afghanistan, a new color-coded threat advisory system being used in the United States, and Osama bin Laden was apparently hiding somewhere in a cave. As always, Barack was absorbing every bit of news carefully, going about his regular business while quietly developing his own thoughts about it all. I don't recall exactly when it was that he first raised the possibility of running for a seat in the U.S. Senate. The idea was still nascent and an actual decision many months away, but clearly it was taking hold in Barack's mind. What I do remember is my response, which was just to look at him incredulously as if to say, "Don't you think we're busy enough?" My distaste for politics was only intensifying, less because of what went on in either Springfield or D.C., and more because 5 years into his tenure as state senator, Barack's overloaded schedule was starting to really grate on me. As Sasha and Malia grew, I found that the pace only quickened and the to-do lists only got longer, leaving me operating in what felt like a never-ending state of overdrive. Barack and I did all we could to keep the girls' lives calm and manageable. We had a new babysitter helping out at home. Malia was happy at her University of Chicago laboratory school, making friends and loading up her own little calendar with birthday parties and swim classes on weekends. Sasha was now about 1 year old, wobbling on 2 feet, and beginning to say words and crack us up with her megawatt smiles. She was madly inquisitive and utterly bent on keeping up with Malia and her 4-year-old buddies. My hospital job was going well, though the best way to stay on top of it, I was discovering, was to hoist myself from bed at 5 a.m. and put in a couple of hours on the computer before anyone else woke up. This left me a little ragged in the evenings and sometimes put me in direct conflict with my night owl husband, who turned up on Thursday nights from Springfield, relatively chipper and wanting to dive headfirst into family life, making up for all the time he'd lost. But time was now officially an issue for us. If Barack's disregard for punctuality had once been something I gently teased him about, it was now a straight-up aggravation. I knew that Thursdays made him happy. I'd hear his excitement when he called to report that he was done with work and finally headed home. I understood it was nothing but good intentions that would lead him to say, "I'm on my way," or "almost home." And for a while, I believed those words. I'd give the girls their nightly bath, but delay bedtime so they could wait up to give their dad a hug. Or I'd feed them dinner and put them to bed, but hold off on eating myself, lighting a few candles and looking forward to sharing a meal with Barack. And then I'd wait. I'd wait so long that Sasha's and Malia's eyelids would start to droop, and I'd have to carry them to bed. Or I'd wait alone, hungry and increasingly bitter, as my own eyes got heavy and candle wax pooled on the table. On my way, I was learning, was the product of Barack's eternal optimism, an indication of his eagerness to be home that did nothing to signify when he would actually arrive. Almost home was not a geolocator, but rather a state of mind. Sometimes he was on his way home, but needed to stop in to have one last 45-minute conversation with a colleague before he got into the car. Other times, he was almost home, but forgot to mention that he was first going to fit in a quick workout at the gym. In our life before children, such frustrations might have seemed petty. But as a working full-time mother, with a half-time spouse and a pre-dawn wake-up time, I felt my patience slipping away until finally, at some point, it just fell off a cliff. When Barack made it home, he'd either find me raging or unavailable, having flipped off every light in the house and gone sullenly to sleep. We live by the paradigms we know. In Barack's childhood, his father disappeared and his mother came and went. She was devoted to him, but never tethered to him. And as far as he was concerned, there was nothing wrong in this approach. He'd had hills, beaches, and his own mind to keep him company. Independence mattered in Barack's world. It always had and always would. I, meanwhile, had been raised inside the tight weave of my own family, in our boxed-in apartment, in our boxed-in Southside neighborhood, with my grandparents and aunts and uncles all around, everyone jammed at one table for our regular Sunday night meals. After 13 years in love, we needed to think through what this meant. When it came down to it, I felt vulnerable when he was away, not because he wasn't fully devoted to our marriage. This is and has always been a meaningful certainty in my life. But because having been brought up in a family where everyone always showed up, I could be extra let down when someone didn't show. I was prone to loneliness, and now also felt fierce about sticking up for the girls' needs, too. We wanted him close. We missed him when he was gone. I worried that he didn't understand what that felt like for us. I feared that the path he'd chosen for himself and still seemed so clearly committed to pursuing would end up steamrolling our every need. When he'd first approached me about running for state senate years earlier, there'd been only two of us to think about. I had no conception of what saying yes to politics might mean for us later, once we'd added two children to the mix. But I now knew enough to understand that politics was never especially kind to families. I'd had a glimpse of it back in high school through my friendship with Santita Jackson, and had seen it again when Barack's political opponents had exploited his decision to stay with Malia in Hawaii when she was sick. Sometimes, watching the news or reading the paper, I found myself staring at images of the people who'd given themselves over to political life. The Clintons, the Gores, the Bushes, old photos of the Kennedys, and wondering what the backstories were. Was everyone normal? Happy? Were those smiles real? At home, our frustrations began to rear up often and intensely. Barack and I loved each other deeply, but it was as if at the center of our relationship, there was suddenly a knot we couldn't loosen. I was 38 years old and had seen other marriages come undone in a way that made me feel protective of ours. I'd had close friends go through devastating breakups, brought on by small problems left unattended or lapses in communication that led eventually to irreparable rifts. A couple of years earlier, my brother Craig had moved temporarily back into the upstairs apartment we'd grown up in, living above our mother after his own marriage had slowly and painfully fallen apart. Barack was reluctant at first to try couples counseling. He was accustomed to throwing his mind at complicated problems and reasoning them out on his own. Sitting down in front of a stranger struck him as uncomfortable, if not a tad dramatic. Couldn't he just run over to Borders and buy some relationship books? Weren't there discussions we could have on our own? But I wanted to really talk and to really listen, and not to do it late at night or during hours we could both be together with the girls. The few people I knew who tried couples counseling and were open enough to talk about it said that it had done them some good. And so I booked us an appointment with a downtown psychologist who came recommended by a friend, and Barack and I went to see him a handful of times. Our counselor, Dr. Woodchurch, let's call him, was a soft-spoken white man who'd gone to good universities and always wore khakis. My assumption was that he would hear what Barack and I had to say and then instantly validate all my grievances, because every last one of those grievances was, as I saw it, absolutely valid. I'm going to guess that Barack might have felt the same way about his own grievances. This turned out to be the big revelation for me about counseling. No validating went on. No sides were taken. When it came to our disagreements, Dr. Woodchurch would never be the deciding vote. Instead, he was an empathic and patient listener, coaxing each of us through the maze of our feelings, separating out our weapons from our wounds. He cautioned us when we got too lawyerly and posited careful questions intended to get us to think hard about why we felt the way we felt. Slowly, over hours of talking, the knot began to loosen. Each time Barack and I left his office, we felt a bit more connected. I began to see that there were ways I could be happier, and that they didn't necessarily need to come from Barack's quitting politics in order to take some 9-to-6 foundation job. If anything, our counseling sessions had shown me that this was an unrealistic expectation. I began to see how I'd been stoking the most negative parts of myself, caught up in the notion that everything was unfair, and then assiduously, like a Harvard-trained lawyer, collecting evidence to feed that hypothesis. I now tried out a new hypothesis. It was possible that I was more in charge of my happiness than I was allowing myself to be. I was too busy resenting Barack for managing to fit workouts into his schedule, for example, to even begin figuring out how to exercise regularly myself. I spent so much energy stewing over whether or not he'd make it home for dinner that dinners with or without him were no longer fun. This was my pivot point, my moment of self-arrest. Like a climber about to slip off an icy peak, I drove my axe into the ground. That isn't to say that Barack didn't make his own adjustments. Counseling helped him to see the gaps in how we communicated, and he worked to be better at it. But I made mine, and they helped me, which then helped us. For starters, I recommitted myself to being healthy. Barack and I belonged to the same gym, run by a jovial and motivating athletic trainer named Cornell McClellan. I'd worked out with Cornell for a couple of years, but having children, it changed my regular routine. My fix for this came in the form of my ever-giving mother, who still worked full-time, but volunteered to start coming over to our house at 4:45 in the morning several days a week so that I could run out to Cornell's and join a girlfriend for a 5 a.m. workout and then be home by 6:30 to get the girls up and ready for their days. This new regimen changed everything. Calmness and strength, two things I feared I was losing, were now back. When it came to the home for dinner dilemma, I installed new boundaries, ones that worked better for me and the girls. We made our schedule and stuck to it. Dinner each night was at 6:30. Baths were at 7, followed by books, cuddling, and lights out at 8 sharp. The routine was ironclad, which put the weight of responsibility on Barack to either make it on time or not. For me, this made so much more sense than holding off dinner or having the girls wait up sleepily for a hug. It went back to my wishes for them to grow up strong and centered, and also unaccommodating to any form of old-school patriarchy. I didn't want them ever to believe that life began when the man of the house arrived home. We didn't wait for Dad. It was his job now to catch up with us. 15. On Claiborne Avenue in Chicago, just north of downtown, there was a strange paradise, seemingly built for the working parent, seemingly built for me. A standard, supremely American, got-it-all strip mall. It had a Baby Gap, a Best Buy, a Gymboree, and a CVS, plus a handful of other chains, small and large, meant to take care of any urgent consumer need, be it a toilet plunger, or a ripe avocado, or a child-sized bathing cap. There was also a nearby Container Store and a Chipotle, which made things even better. This was my place. I could park the car, whip through two or three stores as needed, pick up a burrito bowl, and be back at my desk inside 60 minutes. I excelled at the lunchtime blitz, the replacing of lost socks, the purchasing of gifts for whatever 5-year-old was having a birthday party on Saturday, the stocking and restocking of juice boxes and single-serving applesauce cups. Sasha and Malia were 3 and 6 years old now, feisty, smart, and growing fast. Their energy left me breathless, which only added to the occasional allure of the shopping plaza. There were times when I'd sit in the parked car and eat my fast food alone, with the car radio playing, overcome with relief, impressed with my efficiency. This was life with little kids. This was what sometimes passed for achievement. I had the applesauce, I was eating a meal, everyone was still alive. Look how I'm managing, I wanted to say in those moments to my audience of no one. Does everyone see that I'm pulling this off? This was me at the age of 40. A little bit June Cleaver, a little bit Mary Tyler Moore. On my better days, I gave myself credit for making it happen. The balance of my life was elegant only from a distance, and only if you squinted. But there was at least something there that resembled balance. The hospital job had turned out to be a good one, challenging and satisfying and in line with my beliefs. It astonished me, actually, to see how a big, esteemed institution like a university medical center with 9,500 employees traditionally operated, run primarily by academics who did medical research and wrote papers and who also, in general, seemed to find the neighborhood around them so scary that they wouldn't even cross an off-campus street. For me, that fear was galvanizing. It got me out of bed in the morning. I'd spent most of my life living alongside those barriers, noting the nervousness of white people in my neighborhood, registering all the subtle ways people with any sort of influence seemed to gravitate away from my home community and into clusters of affluence that seemed increasingly far removed. Here was an invitation to undo some of that, to knock down barriers where I could, mostly by encouraging people to get to know one another. I was well supported by my new boss, given the freedom to build my own program, creating a stronger relationship between the hospital and its neighboring community. I started with one person working for me, but eventually led a team of 22. I instituted programs to take hospital staff and trustees out into neighborhoods around the South Side, having them visit community centers and schools, signing them up to be tutors, mentors, and science fair judges, getting them to try the local barbecue joints. We brought local kids in to job shadow hospital employees, set up a program to increase the number of neighborhood people volunteering in the hospital, and worked with a summer academic institute through the medical school, encouraging students in the community to consider medicine as a career. After realizing that the hospital system could be better about hiring minority and women-owned businesses for its contracted work, I helped set up the Office of Business Diversity as well. Finally, there was the issue of people desperately needing care. The South Side had just over 1 million residents and a dearth of medical providers, not to mention a population that was disproportionately affected by the kinds of chronic conditions that tend to afflict the poor: asthma, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease. With huge numbers of people uninsured and many others dependent on Medicaid, patients regularly jammed the university hospital's emergency room, often seeking what amounted to routine non-emergency treatment, or having gone so long without preventative care that they were now in dire need of help. The problem was glaring, expensive, inefficient, and stressful for everyone involved. ER visits did little to improve anyone's long-term health either. Trying to address this problem became an important focus for me. Among other things, we began hiring and training patient advocates, friendly, helpful local people generally, who could sit with patients in the ER, helping them set up follow-up appointments at community health centers and educating them on where they could go to get decent and affordable regular care. My work was interesting and rewarding, but still, I had to be careful not to let it consume me. I felt I owed that to my girls. Our decision to let Barack's career proceed as it had, to give him the freedom to shape and pursue his dreams, led me to tamp down my own efforts at work. Almost deliberately, I numbed myself somewhat to my ambition, stepping back in moments when I'd normally step forward. I'm not sure anyone around me would have said I wasn't doing enough, but I was always aware of everything I could have followed through on and didn't. There were certain small-scale projects I chose not to take on. There were young employees whom I could have mentored better than I did. You hear all the time about the trade-offs of being a working mother. These were mine. If I'd once been someone who threw herself completely into every task, I was now more cautious, protective of my time, knowing I had to maintain enough energy for life at home. My goals mostly involved maintaining normalcy and stability, but those would never be Barack's. We'd grown better about recognizing this and letting it be. One yin, one yang. I craved routine and order, and he did not. He could live in the ocean. I needed the boat. When he was present at home, he was at least impressively present, playing on the floor with the girls, reading Harry Potter out loud with Malia at night, laughing at my jokes and hugging me, reminding us of his love and steadiness before vanishing again for another half a week or more. We made the most of the gaps in his schedule, having meals and seeing friends. He indulged me sometimes by watching Sex and the City. I indulged him sometimes by watching The Sopranos. I'd given myself over to the idea that being away was just part of his job. I didn't like it, but for the most part, I'd stop fighting it. Barack could happily end a day in a faraway hotel with all sorts of political battles brewing and loose ends floating. I, meanwhile, lived for the shelter of home, for the sense of completeness I felt each night with Sasha and Malia tucked into their beds and the dishwasher humming in the kitchen. I had no choice but to adjust to Barack's absences anyway, because they weren't slated to end. On top of his regular work, he was once again campaigning, this time for a seat in the U.S. Senate, ahead of the fall 2004 elections. He'd been slowly growing restless in Springfield, frustrated by the meandering pace of state government, convinced he could accomplish more and better in Washington. Knowing that I had plenty of reasons to be against the idea of a Senate run, and knowing also that he had a counter-argument to present, midway through 2002, we'd convened an informal meeting of maybe a dozen of our closest friends, held over brunch at Valerie Jarrett's house, thinking we would kind of air the whole thing out and see what people thought. Valerie lived in a high-rise not far from us in Hyde Park. Her condo was clean and modern, with white walls and white furniture and sprays of exquisite bright orchids adding color. At the time, she was the executive vice president at a real estate firm and a trustee at the University of Chicago Medical Center. She'd supported my efforts at Public Allies when I was there and helped raise funds for Barack's various campaigns, marshaling her wide network of connections to boost our every endeavor. Because of this, and because of her warm, wise demeanor, Valerie had come to occupy a curious position in our lives. Our friendship was equally personal and professional, and she was equally my friend and Barack's, which in my experience is a rare thing inside a couple. I had my high-powered mom posse, and Barack spent what little leisure time he had playing basketball with a group of buddies. We had some great friends who were couples, their children friends with our children, families we liked to vacation with. But Valerie was something different, a big sister to each of us individually, and someone who helped us stand back and take measure of our dilemmas when they arose. She saw us clearly, she saw our goals clearly, and was protective of us both. She'd also told me privately ahead of time that she wasn't convinced Barack should run for the Senate. So I walked into brunch that morning, figuring I had the argument sewn up. But I'd been wrong. The Senate race presented a unique opportunity, Barack explained that day. He felt he had a real shot. The incumbent, Peter Fitzgerald, was a conservative Republican in an increasingly Democratic state and was having trouble maintaining the support of his own party. It was likely that multiple candidates would run in the primary, which meant that Barack would only need to command a plurality of the vote to win the Democratic nomination. As for money, he assured me that he wouldn't need to touch our personal finances. When I asked how we'd afford living expenses if we were going to have homes in both D.C. and Chicago, he said, "Well, I'll write another book, and it'll be a big book, one that makes money." This made me laugh. Barack was the only person I knew who had this kind of faith, thinking that a book could solve any problem. He was like the little boy from Jack and the Beanstalk, I teased, who trades his family's livelihood for a handful of magic beans, believing with his whole heart that they will yield something, even if no one else does. On all other fronts, Barack's logic was dismayingly solid. I watched Valerie's face as he spoke, realizing that he was quickly racking up points with her, that he had an answer for every "but what about" question we could throw his way. I knew he was making sense, even as I fought off the urge to tally up all the additional hours he'd spend away from us now, not to mention the specter of a move to D.C. Though we'd argued over the drain of his political career on our family for years now, I did love and trust Barack. He was already a man with two families, his attention divided between me and the girls and his 200,000 or so Southside constituents. Would sharing him with the state of Illinois really be all that different? I couldn't know one way or another, but I also couldn't bring myself to stand in the way of his aspiration, that thing always tugging at him to try for more. And so that day, we made a deal. Valerie agreed to be the finance chair for Barack's Senate campaign. A number of our friends agreed to donate time and money to the effort. I signed off on all of it, with one important caveat, repeated out loud so that everyone could hear it. If he lost, he'd move on from politics altogether and find a different sort of job. If it didn't work out on election day, this would be the end. Really and for real, this would be the end. What came next for Barack, though, was a series of lucky twists. First, Peter Fitzgerald decided not to run for re-election, clearing the field for challengers and relative newcomers like my husband. Then, somewhat oddly, both the Democratic frontrunner in the primary and the ensuing Republican nominee became embroiled in scandals involving their ex-wives. With just a few months remaining before the election, Barack didn't even have a Republican opponent. To be sure, he'd been running an excellent campaign, having learned plenty from his failed congressional run. He'd beaten out seven primary opponents and earned more than half the vote to win the nomination. Traveling the state and interacting with potential constituents, he was the same man I knew at home, funny and charming, smart and prepared. His overly verbose answers to questions at town hall forums and campaign debates seemed only to drive home the point that he belonged on the Senate floor. But still, effort notwithstanding, Barack's path to the Senate seemed paved in four-leaf clover. All this, too, was before John Kerry invited him to give the keynote address at the 2004 Democratic National Convention being held in Boston. Kerry, then a senator from Massachusetts, was locked in a back-and-forth fight for the presidency with George W. Bush. My husband was, in all of this, a complete nobody. A humble state legislator who'd never stood before a crowd like the one of 15,000 or more that would be gathered in Boston. He'd never used a teleprompter, never been live on primetime television. He was a newcomer, a black man in what was historically a white man's business, surfacing from obscurity with a weird name and odd backstory, hoping to strike a chord with a common Democrat. As the network pundits would later acknowledge, choosing Barack Obama to speak to an audience of millions had been a mighty gamble. And yet, in his curious and roundabout way, he seemed destined for exactly this moment. I knew because I'd seen up close how his mind churned nonstop. Over years, I'd watched him inhale books, newspapers, and ideas, sparking to life any time he spoke with someone who offered a shard of new experience or knowledge. He'd stowed every piece of it. What he was building, I see now, was a vision, and not a small one either. It was the very thing I'd had to create room for in our shared life, to coexist with, even if reluctantly. It aggravated me sometimes to no end, but it was also what I could never disavow in Barack. He'd been working at this thing, quietly and meticulously, as long as I'd known him. And now maybe the size of the audience would finally match the scope of what he believed to be possible. He'd been ready for that call. All he had to do was speak. "Must have been a good speech," became my refrain afterward. It was a joke between me and Barack, one I repeated often and with irony following that night, July 27, 2004. I'd left the girls at home with my mother and flown to be with him in Boston for the speech, standing in the wings at the convention center as Barack stepped into the hot glare of the stage lights and into view of all those millions of people. He was a little nervous, and so was I, though we were both determined not to show it. This was how Barack operated anyway. The more pressure he was under, the calmer he seemed to get. He'd written his remarks over the course of a couple of weeks, working on them in between Illinois Senate votes. He memorized his words and rehearsed them carefully, to the point where he wouldn't actually need the teleprompter unless his nerves got triggered and his mind went blank. But that wasn't at all what happened. Barack looked out at the audience and into the TV cameras, and as if kick-starting some internal engine, he just smiled and began to roll. He spoke for 17 minutes that night, explaining who he was and where he came from, his grandfather, a GI who joined Patton's army, his grandmother who'd worked on an assembly line during the war, his father who'd grown up herding goats in Kenya, his parents' improbable love, their faith in what a good education could do for a son who wasn't born rich or well-connected. Earnestly and expertly, he cast himself not as an outsider, but rather as a literal embodiment of the American story. He reminded the audience that a country couldn't be carved up simply into red and blue, that we were united by a common humanity, compelled to care for the whole of society. He called for hope over cynicism. He spoke with hope, projected hope, almost sang with it, really. It was 17 minutes of Barack's deft and easy way with words. 17 minutes of his deep, dazzling optimism on display. By the time he finished, with a last plug for John Kerry and his running mate, John Edwards, the crowd was on its feet and roaring, the applause booming in the rafters. I walked onto the stage, stepping into the blinding lights, wearing high heels and a white suit, to give Barack a congratulatory hug before turning to wave with him at the whipped-up audience. The energy was electric, the sound absolutely deafening. That Barack was a good person with a big mind and a serious faith in democracy was no longer any sort of secret. I was proud of what he'd done, though it didn't surprise me. This was the guy I'd married. I'd known his capabilities all along. Looking back, I think it was then that I quietly began to let go of the idea that there was any reversing his course, that he'd ever belong solely to me and the girls. I could hear it almost in the pulse of the applause. More of this, more of this, more of this. The media response to Barack's speech was hyperbolic. "I've just seen the first black president," Chris Matthews declared to his fellow commentators on NBC. A front-page headline in the Chicago Tribune the next day read simply, "The Phenom." Barack's cell phone began to ring nonstop. Cable pundits were dubbing him a rock star and an overnight success, as if he hadn't spent years working up to that moment on stage, as if the speech had created him instead of the other way around. Still, the speech was the beginning of something new, not just for him, but for us, our whole family. we were swept into another level of exposure and into the swift current of other people's expectations. It was surreal, the whole thing. All I could do, really, was joke about it. Must have been a good speech, I'd say with a shrug as people began stopping Barack on the street to ask for his autograph or tell him they'd loved what he said. Must have been a good speech, I said when we walked out of a restaurant in Chicago to find that a crowd had gathered on the sidewalk to wait for him. I said the same thing when journalists started asking for Barack's thoughts on important national issues, when big-time political strategists started to hover around him, and when 9 years after publication, the formerly obscure Dreams from My Father got a paperback reissue and landed on the New York Times bestseller list. Must have been a good speech, I said, when a beaming, bustling Oprah Winfrey showed up at our house to spend a day interviewing us for her magazine. What was happening to us? I almost couldn't track it. In November, Barack was elected to the U.S. Senate, winning 70% of the vote statewide, the largest margin in Illinois history, and the biggest landslide of any Senate race in the country that year. He'd won significant majorities among blacks, whites, and Latinos, men and women, rich and poor, urban, suburban, and rural. At one point, we went to Arizona for a quick getaway, and he was mobbed by well-wishers there. This, for me, felt like a true and odd measure of his fame. Even white people were recognizing him now. I took what was left of my normalcy and wrapped myself in it. When we were at home, everything was the same. When we were with our friends and family, everything was the same. With our kids, it was always the same. But outside, things were different. Barack was flying back and forth to D.C. all the time now. He had a Senate office and an apartment in a shabby building on Capitol Hill, a little one-bedroom that was already cluttered with books and papers, his hole away from home. Anytime the girls and I came to visit, we didn't even pretend to want to stay there, booking a hotel room for the four of us instead. I stuck to my routine in Chicago. Gym, work, home, repeat. Dishes in the dishwasher, swim lessons, soccer, ballet. I kept pace as I always had. Barack had a life in Washington now, operating with some of the gravitas that came with being a senator, but I was still me, living my same normal life. I was sitting one day in my parked car at the shopping plaza on Clybourne Avenue, having some Chipotle and a little me time after a dash through Baby Gap, when my secretary at work called on my cell phone to ask if she could patch through a call. It was from a woman in D.C., someone I'd never met, the wife of a fellow senator, who'd tried a few times already to reach me. Sure, put her through, I said. And on came the voice of the senator's wife, pleasant and warm. Well, hello, she said. I'm so glad to finally talk to you. I told her that I was excited to talk to her, too. I'm just calling to welcome you, she said, and to let you know that we'd like to invite you to join something very special. She'd called to ask me to be in some sort of private organization, a club that, from what I gathered, was made up primarily of the wives of important people in Washington. They got together regularly for luncheons and to discuss issues of the day. It's a nice way to meet people, and I know that it's not always easy when you're new to town, she said. In my whole life, I'd never been asked to join a club. I'd watched friends in high school go off on ski trips with their Jack and Jill groups. At Princeton, I'd waited up sometimes for Suzanne to come home, buzzed and tittering from her eating club parties. Half the lawyers at Sidley, it seemed, belonged to country clubs. I'd visited plenty of those clubs over time, raising money for Public Allies, raising money for Barack's campaigns. You learned early on that clubs in general were saturated with money. Belonging signified more than just belonging. It was a kind offer she was making, coming from a genuine place. And yet I was all too happy to turn it down. "Thank you," I said. "It's so nice of you to think of me, but actually, we've made the decision I won't be moving to Washington." I let her know that we had two little girls in school in Chicago and that I was pretty attached to my job. I explained that Barack was settling into life in D.C., commuting home when he could. I didn't mention that we were so committed to Chicago that we were looking to buy a new house, thanks to the royalty money that was starting to come in from the renewed sales of his book, and the fact that he now had a generous offer on a second book, The Surprise Harvest of Barack's Magic Beans. The senator's wife paused, letting a delicate beat pass. When she spoke again, her voice was gentle. "That can be very hard on a marriage, you know," she said. "Families fall apart." I felt her judgment then. She herself had been in Washington for many years. The implication was she'd seen things go poorly when a spouse stayed back. The implication was that I was making a dangerous choice, that there was only one correct way to be a senator's wife, and I was choosing wrong. I thanked her again, hung up, and sighed. None of this had been my choice in the first place. None of this was my choice at all. I was now, like her, the wife of a U.S. senator. Mrs. Obama, she'd called me throughout the conversation. But that didn't mean I had to drop everything to support him. Truly, I didn't want to drop a thing. I knew there were other senators with spouses who chose to live in their hometowns rather than in D.C. I knew that the Senate, with 14 of its 100 members being female, was not quite as antiquated as it had once been. But still, I found it presumptuous that another woman would tell me I was wrong to want to keep my kids in school and remain in my job. A few weeks after the election, I'd gone with Barack to Washington for a day-long orientation offered to newly elected senators and their spouses. There'd been only a few of us attending that year, and after a quick introduction, the politicians went one way while the spouses were ushered into another room. I'd come with questions, knowing that politicians and their families were expected to adhere to strict federal ethics policies, dictating everything from whom they could receive gifts from to how they paid for travel to and from Washington. I thought maybe we'd discuss how to navigate social situations with lobbyists or the legalities of raising money for a future campaign. What we got, however, was an elaborate disquisition on the history and architecture of the Capitol, and a look at the official china patterns produced for the Senate, followed by a polite and chit-chatty lunch. The whole thing had gone on for hours. It would have been funny, maybe, if I hadn't taken a day off from work and left our kids with my mother in order to be there. If I was going to be a political spouse, I wanted to treat it seriously. I didn't care about the politics per se, but I also didn't want to screw anything up. The truth was that Washington confused me with its decorous traditions and sober self-regard, its whiteness and maleness, its ladies having lunch off to the side. At the heart of my confusion was a kind of fear, because as much as I hadn't chosen to be involved, I was getting sucked in. I'd been Mrs. Obama for the last 12 years, but it was starting to mean something different. At least in some spheres, I was now Mrs. Obama in a way that could feel diminishing, a Mrs. defined by her Mr. I was the wife of Barack Obama, the political rock star, the only black person in the Senate, the man who'd spoken of hope and tolerance so poignantly and forcefully that he now had a hornet buzz of expectation following him. My husband was a senator, but somehow people seemed to want to vault right over that. Instead, everyone was keen to know whether he would make a run for president in 2008. There was no shaking the question. Every reporter asked it. Nearly every person who approached him on the street asked it. My colleagues at the hospital would stand in my doorway and casually drop the question, probing for some bit of early news. Even Malia, who was 6 and a half on the day she put on a pink velvet dress and stood next to Barack as he was sworn into the Senate by Dick Cheney, wanted to know. Unlike many of the others, though, our first grader was wise enough to sense how premature it all seemed. "Daddy, are you going to try to be president?" she'd asked. "Don't you think maybe you should be vice president or something first?" I was with Malia on this matter. As a lifelong pragmatist, I would always counsel a slow approach, the methodical checking of boxes. I was a natural-born fan of the long and judicious wait. In this regard, I felt better any time I heard Barack pushing back at his inquisitors with an aw shucks kind of modesty, batting away questions about the presidency, saying that the only thing he was planning was to put his head down and work hard in the Senate. He often reminded people that he was just a low-ranking member of the minority party, a backbench player if there ever was one. And he would sometimes add he had 2 kids he needed to raise. But the drum was already beating. It was hard to make it stop. Barack was writing what would become The Audacity of Hope, thinking through his beliefs and his vision for the country, threshing them into words on his legal pads late at night. He really was content, he told me, to stay where he was, building his influence over time, awaiting his turn to speak inside the deliberative cacophony of the Senate. But then a storm arrived. Hurricane Katrina blasted the Gulf Coast of the United States late in August 2005, overwhelming the levees in New Orleans, swamping low-lying regions, stranding people, black people mostly, on the rooftops of their destroyed homes. The aftermath was horrific, with media reports showing hospitals without backup power, distraught families herded into the Superdome, emergency workers hamstrung by a lack of supplies. In the end, some 1,800 people died, and more than 500,000 others were displaced. A tragedy exacerbated by the ineptitude of the federal government's response. It was a wrenching exposure of our country's structural divides, most especially the intense, lopsided vulnerability of African Americans and poor people of all races when things got rough. Where was hope now? I watched the Katrina coverage with a knot in my stomach, knowing that if a disaster hit Chicago, many of my aunts and uncles, cousins and neighbors would have suffered a similar fate. Barack's reaction was no less emotional. A week after the hurricane, he flew to Houston to join former President George H.W. Bush, along with Bill and Hillary Clinton, who was then a colleague of his in the Senate, spending time with the tens of thousands of New Orleans evacuees who'd sought shelter in the Astrodome there. The experience kindled something in him, that nagging sense he wasn't yet doing enough. This was the thought I returned to a year or so later, when the drumbeat truly got loud, when the pressure on both of us felt immense. We went about our regular business, but the question of whether Barack would run for president unsettled the air around us. Could he? Will he? Should he? In the summer of 2006, poll respondents filling out open-ended questionnaires were naming him as a presidential possibility, though Hillary Clinton was decidedly the number one pick. By fall, though, Barack's stock had begun to rise in part thanks to the publication of The Audacity of Hope and a slew of media opportunities afforded by the book tour. His poll numbers were suddenly even with or ahead of those of Al Gore and John Kerry, the Democrats' previous two nominees, evidence of his potential. I was aware that he'd been having private conversations with friends, advisors, and prospective donors, signaling to everyone that he was mulling over the idea. But there was one conversation he avoided having, and that was with me. He knew, of course, how I felt. We discussed it obliquely around the edges of other topics. We'd lived with other people's expectations so long that they were almost embedded in every conversation we had. Barack's potential sat with our family at the dinner table. Barack's potential rode along to school with the girls and to work with me. It was there even when we didn't want it to be there, adding a strange energy to everything. From my point of view, my husband was doing plenty already. If he was going to even think about running for president, I'd hoped he'd take the prudent path, preparing slowly, biding his time in the Senate, and waiting until the girls were older, until 2016, maybe. Since I'd known him, it seemed to me that Barack had always had his eye on some far-off horizon, on this notion of the world as it should be. Just for once, I wanted him to be content with life as it was. I didn't understand how he could look at Sasha and Malia, now 5 and 8, with their pigtailed hair and giggly exuberance, and feel any other way. It hurt me sometimes to think that he did. We were riding a seesaw, the two of us, the Mr. on one side and the Mrs. on the other. We lived in a nice house now, a Georgian brick home on a quiet street in the Kenwood neighborhood, with a wide porch and tall trees in the yard. Exactly the kind of place Craig and I used to gape at during Sunday drives in my dad's Buick. I thought often of my father and all he'd invested in us. I wished desperately for him to be alive to see how things were playing out. Craig was profoundly happy now, having finally made a swerve, leaving his career in investment banking and pivoting back to his first love, basketball. After a few years as an assistant at Northwestern, he was now head coach at Brown University in Rhode Island, and he was getting married again to Kelly McCrum, a beautiful down-to-earth college dean of admissions from the East Coast. His two children had grown tall and confident, vibrant advertisements for what the next generation could do. I was a senator's wife, but beyond that, and more important, I had a career that mattered to me. Back in the spring, I'd been promoted to become a vice president at the University of Chicago Medical Center. I'd spent the past couple of years leading the development of a program called the Southside Healthcare Collaborative, which had already connected more than 1,500 patients who turned up in our emergency department with care providers they could see regularly, regardless of whether they could pay or not. My work felt personal. I saw Black folks streaming into the ER with issues that had long been neglected, diabetic patients whose circulation issues had gone untended and who now needed a leg amputated, for example, and couldn't help but think of every medical appointment my own father had failed to make for himself, every symptom of his MS he downplayed in order not to make a fuss or cost anyone money or generate paperwork or to spare himself the feeling of being belittled by a wealthy white doctor. I liked my job, and while it wasn't perfect, I also liked my life. With Sasha about to move into elementary school, I felt as though I was at the start of a new phase, on the brink of being able to fire up my ambition again and consider a new set of goals. What would a presidential campaign